KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, Mike Kelly, has a fascinating way of bringing the complications of sexual politics of several eras to television. You should know him for the show Swingtown, which ran on CBS a few years ago. Didn't run nearly as long as it should. He's rectified that with his new show, Revenge, on ABC, which is the monster dramatic hit of the season. Mike, thanks for being here, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
What's fascinating to me about the way you've worked, and in all these shows you've done, worked on AC, the OC rather, not the AC, but the OC, and One Tree Hill, is the way sex kind of complicates and people think it's going to simplify things, mm-hmm. when in fact it does not. Where does that come from for you?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess growing up, certainly with Swingtown, it was in the late 70s. I was a kid, and it was a time of change for everybody. And I think that the way that sexual politics had sort of trickled down from the the city centers in New York and Los Angeles, they kind of made their way to the suburbs by the time I was 8 years old and 9 years old. And all the parents on the block started experimenting, and they kind of got a free card for a minute. And a lot of these people had never been with anyone in any intimate way outside of their spouse. And so when they began to experimenting, and that's when sort of divorces started happening, and the swinging came into play, and it was that's how it all began, just sort of being an observer. I always called myself a banister slat kid. I'd watch my parents' parties, and I'd see what was going on, and a lot of it kind of played off in my imagination, and then made its way to television. But I always thought, I always think of what I do as really a search for intimacy and a search for understanding, and sex plays a big role in that. But I think for me, it's about love at the end, and the lack of it, or in the case of Revenge, having that ripped away from you, and the constant search to rectify that.
But underneath, I can say this, I think about both Swingtown and Revenge, sex infantilizes people, mm-hmm. but it's also about the way women can use sex for power.
Sure.
And that was really starting to become clear. I mean, after sort of the lighter moments, the beginning of Swingtown, the way sex became kind of a power dynamic, mm-hmm. was becoming much clearer, and I was wanting to see that played out more. And you seem to have picked up on that with Revenge.
Well, it seems to be, the historic biological entree for women into the patriarchal society. You've really, that's the one thing that they have that a man can't get anywhere else, really. So they hold that. They do hold that power, and have since the beginning of men and women. So I'd like to think that while it can be an entree, that there's a lot more, to women, obviously, than whether or not they hold or withhold their sexuality from a man in order to create a power situation. But that's certainly a simple way to do it for a simple male character when you're trying to get in there. Emily Thorne, the character.
Played by Emily Van Camp, yes.
Let's be clear. She definitely does use her powers of seduction to get into the family through Daniel, through the young man.
We should have you at this point explain for sort of a thumbnail of what Revenge is for people who haven't got up with it yet.
Revenge was sort of born from an idea that generated inside of ABC, the president, Paul Lee, and his gang. They wanted to do something with The Count of Monte Cristo. He thought that was a really, that Revenge was a terrific story engine, and he's right. The trick was to figure out how to bring that to a modern audience, and how there are several, in the story of The Count of Monte Cristo, it takes place over 20 years.
Decades, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, and so we had to figure out a way around that, and rather than making the person who was wronged watching that play out in a complicated way, we decided to make it the daughter who was avenging her father, and it was a way in that allowed us obviously to get on the air and reach the ABC audience. And it grew into this, you know, I've always loved soap operas and nighttime dramas, I guess, if I want to be sophisticated. but I loved, I mean, I loved Abby Ewing from Knott's Landing, and I love those strong female characters that Heather Locklear's character, Amanda, on Melrose Place was also terrific. And so I just, I was like those iconic sort of female power figures on television and thought, let's get a real kick-ass sort of anti-heroine on the air and see where we go. So we've got actually two of them in Madeline Stowe's character, Victoria Grayson, and her foe in hiding, Emily Thorne.
We're talking about sophistication with the creator of Revenge, Mike Kelly. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. But, you know, just sort of skimming over the book again last week, The Count of Monte Cristo is about his maturing, too.
Right.
And also, in the end, about forgiveness.
Yes, well, exactly. That's the trick of this show. And so I began the journey on Revenge in the pilot. I started with her voiceover, and we began and end each episode.
But you came with that Confucius quote.
You're exactly right. Start with the Confucius quote, which is, before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves. So she knows very well what she's getting into. And I think that is our guiding principle here, that she knows this is a very dangerous game that she's playing, or proposition. But she also says in the voiceover, emphatically, this is not a story about forgiveness.
That's why I brought that up, because it's...
It is. I mean, it's the only way out of revenge is forgiveness, really, or destruction. So one of those two things will come to pass by the end of this, of our 50 years on air.
Well, it's funny you say that, because... Also, the point of The Count of Monte Cristo is that he dies and becomes another person.
Yes.
And through becoming another person, yeah, learns to forgive, because he has to forgive himself.
That's absolutely right. Good research. Yeah, Edmund.
Edmund Dantes, yes.
There's so many terrific templates inside within that story that we use as we go through, as we build a season. A lot of these takedowns that we call, you know, the people that have wronged her family.
And in the first few episodes, there was a takedown every week. Yeah. You moved away from that a little bit.
I did. That was by design. We really wanted a hook for everybody. We wanted people to enjoy that visceral sort of vicarious thrill you get by watching somebody take somebody down, destroy them. And then we wanted to start using what was happening to this character, the psychology of taking revenge on people, to start taking a bit of a toll on her. And we wanted to give the audience some time to get to know our regular characters and then build out the larger twists and turns of the story, so that we didn't have to rely on a takedown each week. We can make it more pointed now, and we can make it more personal now. The first few were almost easy. They were kind of batting practice, you know, for her, like, you know, like a cat with a ball of yarn. Things get a lot more complicated as we get into the season for her.
Because one of the things we should say is it's the Count of Monte Cristo set in the contemporary Hamptons. I wondered if when Emily goes away to prison, as basically she's put away in foster homes, mm-hmm, and juvenile detention centers as a little girl, if that's your way of saying that's when Emily Thorne died.
That's when Amanda Clark died. Her original name is Amanda Clark.
Sorry, exactly,
and Emily Thorne was born. She created, actually, you know, we're doing this really interesting episode, which will explain, it's her first contact after she gets out of juvenile detention and as an 18-year-old, and she finds out that her father has died in prison. And he has given her a box filled with his secrets and all these journals that tell her what happened to him, at least by his guess. And she, as an 18-year-old, ignores all of this for some time, for about 6 months. This is what you're going to find. And then something happens, and she ends up in the Hamptons for a New Year's Eve party, where she gets herself into this party as a waitress, and
we see little clips of that.
And you
in
do
the show.
Well, you see this whole, and so you she meets all of these characters that you're going to take down. So we're bringing back all of the people she's taken down this season. You're going to see in episode 20, I think it airs in May sweeps, and at the end of this is when truly Amanda dies.
It's quite a mouthful for my guest, Mike Kelly. He's the creator of the show Revenge on ABC. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. What I do find so fascinating about this, though, is about personal journals constantly being kept,
mm-hmm,
and of the protagonist as an unreliable narrator.
Yeah, especially unreliable when it's your father, the father that you didn't really know and that you're learning to, you know, you're coming to know through his skewed perspective, you know, and he's only telling you what he wants you to know. So she's going to learn as she goes through this journey that she didn't have all the information on her father, and that there's a you know, many shades of gray on this than she would have liked. It's not black and white. And quite the same way with the characters that she came to destroy, the people that she held responsible. They're not just the blueprint that she had in her head. That, you know, Victoria is a complicated woman who actually did love her father and made some horrible choices for reasons of her own, which we also get to explore as we
see in the show. Seems to still be carrying a torch for Emily / Amanda's father.
Yes, absolutely. We'll learn more about her, and we learn that Daniel is, you know, she thought he was this entitled little brat that got away with almost murder, and she thought he would be great to seduce and get into the family, and then, oh my God, he's an actual person. He's just as under Victoria's thumb as her father probably was, and she then develops sympathy for him and then real feelings for him.
See, that's the question a lot of us have, because the way Emily Van Camp plays it, mm-hmm. she shows real range because she's two mm-hmm. different people. I mean, when she's by herself, she's completely expressionless. I mean, the only sort of affection she shows is for her dog, who must be the oldest dog in the world by this point. But that's another conversation. But a number of us, friends of mine who are fans, and I've turned on to the show because I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Find themselves saying, what are her real feelings for Daniel, who she wants to try to use against as kind of mm-hmm. a cudgel against the family? Because it seems like she's completely self-aware, but also falling in love with him at the mm-hmm. same time.
Well, I think that she begins to reassess what she wants as the story progresses, what revenge means to her. And for me, the idea of turning Daniel against his nature, against his DNA, against being a Grayson, against his mother and his father, and really giving him the opportunity to choose to be better than that is in many ways a better revenge than destroying the son that they love. Building him into a better person starts to become a really a viable way to take out revenge on these, to take his loyalty away from his parents. So his loyalty then shifts to her. I think him becoming a better person starts informing her feelings for him. And, you know, she does not push it. She actually allows him the free will to choose where he's going to go. And I'm not going to tell you what he chooses, but
you're so close anyway. Well, you might as well tell me.
Well, let's just say that Daniel does take a bit of a dark turn. So as we move forward, and it makes, again, it refocuses her on what her task at hand is, and the nature of people. And, you know, we also have Jack, the bartender, on, you know, that's sort of pure soul on the other side of the fence that she's kind of buried her heart in a long time ago. So that's a very precious thing that he has, a power that he has. And she's going to be attracted to that.
Because the question that Dumas asked in almost all his stories, and to some extent Conrad did too, was the question of fundamental decency. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be kind of central to what you do with the show.
Yeah, I think that's an important theme for me. And, you know, the search for that also is interesting to me. I think that we all would like to believe in our better selves. And I think we would all like to point our fingers elsewhere at the things that make us do bad things. You know, it doesn't come organically to us. We need to be wronged before we start doing bad things, for the most part. And I think that it's really interesting. Emily's doing terrible things. She's made a life of it. She's committed herself to it. And I think that she'll find that hopefully if I do my job right, it's an empty pursuit in the end, and you're going to be rooting for her to forgive. It might take a while to get there.
I'm hoping it does. We'll take a break. My guest is Mike Kelly, the creator of one of my favorite new shows, Revenge is the Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is Mike Kelly. He's the creator of the new ABC series. Well, I guess now no longer new, coming near the end of its first season, the ABC series Revenge. One of the things, too, that is kind of fascinating to me about what you do is you very much are about class warfare. Mm-hmm. I mean, class and the way the middle class was sort of basically in self-immolation was very much a part of what Swingtown was.
Yes.
How that conventional conception of the middle class was being burned away as women were starting to stand up for themselves. Here it's a very different kind of class warfare, but it's fascinating to see you basically using what feel like almost Marxist tenets in these shows that you've done.
Wow, I never thought of it that way. But yeah, I guess as far as class warfare goes, it seems that the times that these stories were, you know, in Swingtown in the 70s, you know, I titled it Swingtown, not just because the neighbors were experimenting with bed hopping, but because I thought of sort of a pendulum, a swing in culture, that this, you know, this town was sort of caught as the pendulum in the 70s was swinging from the far right and the Nixon era and Ford and swinging into a time of exploration, you know, and it was a really fun era to explore. Currently, we're in a political moment where the haves and the have-nots are so deeply separated. And there's such mistrust of politics, and there's such mistrust of your neighbor and of wealth and how you acquire it and what you do with it. And I don't understand, frankly, the idea of not wanting to share wealth in a way, share knowledge in a way, share anything to help make the greater society better. So I suppose that there is a bit of that. Let's not forget that Emily has a ton of money at her disposal.
Which is completely meaningless to her, though, is for creature comfort.
It is.
Because she leads a very ascetic life once she's not out sort of throwing her money around.
Right. It's a modest sort of cottage that she lives in. And she is, you know, we're going to find out what else she does with her money as we go.
Because she has kind of a sensei, too.
She does have a sensei.
Who's a very big star in Japan.
yeah, he's terrific. Hiro is great. And he's, he came to us from international, basically, sales at ABC wanted to try to get Japan to put this on the air in prime time, which they haven't done with a network or with an American show in some time. And they were sweetening sort of the deal by saying, let's bring a star from Japan and see if we can find a character for him in the show. And I had already had the idea that she had this mentor, you know, this sensei. They just came both at the perfect time. So it actually accelerated. I wasn't going to bring him in till a little bit later, but it seemed to work. I understand we're going to be airing in Japan if we're not
already. Oh, congratulations.
I love these happy sort of accidents and these little adventures that you can take. You have a goal in mind, but you know, kind of like taking a cross-country trip. You want to stop off wherever you feel like. So as long as I know where I'm headed, I like being able to say, oh sure, let's see if we can bring this character in now, or let's explore that. And Hiro was a terrific example of those two things.
We're talking about accidents with the creator of Revenge, Mike Kelly. It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. But we're going to go back to Dumas. I mean, the idea of faith, mm-hmm. you know, is so key to him.
Yes.
And where does that lie in Revenge for you?
Well, I think for Emily, it lies in the same place it sort of lies for me. Her faith is, well, it's developing, it's growing, it's finding its own path. But for her faith is going to be in other people. It's not so much a spirituality and a belief in a higher power. I think that she didn't receive that gift, I guess, and growing up, and she didn't have that sort of structure. And she was wronged in so many ways. She didn't have trust in authority on her, and I think that for her, trust is her faith, and is sort of that big mystery for her, being able to trust somebody. And so for her, her faith is going to be built around trust and people and her community and building a family. The idea, the sort of magic of a family that you choose, being reliable. I think that her faith is going to be about family, and it's not going to be a broader, as Dumas was fascinated by that and the priest and all that.
Christianity was key to that.
Huge. And that was, you know, that was it was also very political, time that he chose to write about.
It was also an attack on the status quo as well.
That's right.
And an attack on basically sort of the Christian hegemony that ruled France.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, they were in a really similar situation, frankly, as we are. I mean, we've got all of these things at play politically, you know, and on evangelicalism and the far right. And I find it fascinating. I don't really participate too much inside of it, but I find the whole discussion and the battle really to not be anything new, frankly. And so when we tap into this as storytellers, you know you're on pretty fertile ground because it repeats itself, you know, generationally and every 100 years, every 1,000 years, every 1,000,000 years, I'm sure.
Well, one of the things that you do that I just find to be so much fun is in casting, especially the Graysons, you've cast people who look like royalty. I mean, you've that's been kind of right down to pulling William Devane out on Knott's Landing and bringing him into this,
yep.
bringing him into Revenge. Talk to me about the way you cast the show.
With Emily, I really liked
Emily
her.
Emily Van Camp.
Yeah, Emily Van Camp, sorry. She I can't remember exactly how she came up to us, but I know that she was interested in doing this project. And
she must have been, because it was something very different from anything she has ever done before.
That's right. You know, she wanted to prove herself in this arena, and she really did. I when I sat down and met with her early on, I knew that that was going to be the person that was going to play this part. I really felt that. And we worked hard to get that, the approval there. I think that ABC had some reservations about whether, because they had her on, they liked her very much, and they knew she was a very capable
actor. But when she was on Brothers and Sisters, she had nothing to do. She's basically like the smiling girlfriend.
That's right. And I said, but that's the way in, guys. Like, that's what's so exciting is that she's not, you wouldn't suspect her. For me, I can't imagine somebody else playing this part, and that's when you know you've really cast it right. I feel the same way about Madeline Stowe, who's a terrific actress.
And 20 years ago, she would have been Emily Thorne, wouldn't she?
20 years ago, she would have been Emily Thorne. And she really, you know, Madeline is terrific because she sees the humanity and the pathos within this character. This very wicked, terrible woman. But we've worked hard to come up with a backstory for her that helps her understand, you know, when she's doing these terrible things. And I think it surprises a lot of people that she's just not the person you love to hate. You also have feelings for her, and you want her to grow also. You want her to want her to forgive. You want her to be forgiven. And yet you also want to see her ruin people when she's pushed. Like it's fun. So yeah, casting for me, it's very it needs to be organic to the material. In Swingtown, you know, Molly Parker is such a revelation. She's so there's an openness to her, and there's an accessibility, and there's something about her that's curious and wants more, but she's timid at the same time because of what she grew up in. So you can get really lucky sometimes. I mean, a lot of things have to come together for the cast to happen, especially when you're doing a pilot, because there's such a scramble for every capable actor out there. But yeah, we got lucky with this cast, and you know, we chose wisely, I think, too.
I think I chose wisely by having you here. It's Mike Kelly is the creator of the show Revenge on ABC. This is The Treatment, which you can hear at KCRW.com. But I'm fascinated by the way you choose women, because Molly Park was not somebody you would expect to be in the show like mm-hmm. Swingtown, and Madeline Stowe and Emily Van Camp are not the people you expect to be in the show like Revenge. You're basically casting by seeing, you can take parts of a persona that they're kind of recognized for and using those in small ways to inform the characters, aren't you?
Absolutely. You know, a really great example of that, I have two of them from Swingtown, is our Miriam Shore and Lana Paria. Miriam, in particular, she brought, again, it's kind of like Madeline does to Victoria, who's wicked, the deep insecurities.
But also, when you have these wicked characters, unlike the shows you're talking about in the 80s, they get no pleasure out of being wicked. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about it, you know, because there's a kind of thing in what we consider to be nighttime drama where women, if they had mustaches, they would, like, twirl them. But your women who are ostensibly villain basically derive no satisfaction from doing these bad acts.
Yes, we make sure they shave before they come on onto the set.
But this almost goes back to that sort of Dumont thing where everybody is tortured. Yep. You know, I mean, if you read The Count of Monte Cristo, there's no happiness in it until the last chapter.
That's absolutely right. this is one of the reasons why the balance for me on Revenge was really important, as it was in Swingtown. But the idea that you have these unhappy, deeply unhappy people that are making choices that just further their unhappiness, you know, and a lot of that is wrapped up in money. And it's not an indictment of capitalism so much as
it is.
No, because I think that there's a little bit, but maybe I mean there's value in living well and wanting opportunities, and I believe in that. But I also think that there's you need to share as well, and you need to. The reason I was saying that there's a balance where you have the Porter family, the Jack Porter and his brother Declan, and they lost their father, and they have a bar that's struggling, and it was important to represent both sides of the economy, and there's a lot of frustration and anger and ugliness on you know the downside of the economy, and there's a lot of charity and kindness and gratitude on the other side. I mean, you look at Bill Gates, and you look at who's doing some amazing work.
Or Warren Buffett, for that matter.
And Warren Buffett. And so there's the hope for that. It's just not as fun to watch.
Well, that's why I'm saying. I think the show is so much fun because like in Counting Monte Cristo, nobody's happy. But except for in sort of both cases, you've given Emily kind of an aide de camp. Mm-hmm. Who definitely has a capacity for pursuing real pleasure in a way that no one else does on the show.
Yes. You know, we're going to give her moments of happiness, moments of joy, like things that there's hope for her, you know. And once she starts embracing some of that, it also can get taken away from her, and it can make her just like even more
mistrustful.
Angry and mistrustful. But we're going to make, I don't want to keep her as a joyless person. I don't think that that's going to be fun to watch for very long.
Well, let's say you get to do 7 years of this. I mean, does she come through the other side the way he did Count of Monte Cristo? Does she come through and realize that basically as a grown person, as an adult, you have to forgive yourself and then forgive others? Is that what you want to see this coming out of the other side?
I have two endings in mind. I'm not sure. Both of them are extremely valid. And I haven't decided which one I want, how I want to end this. I think that but they're both extremely valid, and they're both exactly, you know, that's the fun of the show.
Did you think that she would end up moving more towards kindness than she has so far?
I did. I thought that because that's my nature. But you know, you let the story sort of guide you. And this show has had an energy unto itself. It's hard to explain, but you get it. It seems to. It drives its own story. It sounds very strange, but it feels like
it becomes its own thing. Doesn't it?
It does. You begin to understand what's working and what's not, and what feels like an episode of Revenge. I can't tell you how many times we've had, you know, scripts come in that seemed great at story breaking stage and seemed like they would be the next step that just don't feel right. And then nobody loves rebreaking scripts. Nobody wants to unravel story, but this show really it has a feel to it, and so right now, yeah, it feels we're going dark right now as we head into the back half of the season. So we'll see where the show wants to end.
Well, we're out of time, Mike. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. Really, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is Mike Kelly, the creator of the very successful nighttime drama Revenge on ABC. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is JC Swanick, who also mixes the show. It's edited by producer Jenny Radelet. I don't want revenge. I'm Elvis Mitch. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.